Hello? Welcome to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. Inside Tennessee is sponsored by the Tennessee Action Council, an educational organization dedicated to restoring constitutionally limited government and the Judeo-Christian values that made our country great. Visit our website at www.tn4action.com. That's tn4action.com. The phone number to call in and join a conversation is 718-305-7176. That is 718-305-7176. Appreciate you tuning in tonight to hear us. Got some good guests lined up for you. We've got John Harris. He's the president of the Tennessee Firearms Association. Anything involving the issue of firearms in Tennessee, John's been involved with, I can guarantee you that. A little later on, we're going to have Representative Tim Wergo. He's actually my representative. He represents Stuart, Benton, and Henry counties. And after that, we're going to have Bill Hopp from he's the president and founder of Tennesseans Against Forced Annexation. So he's going to give us a little history on that and kind of tell us what was accomplished in the legislature last year and what we can expect to happen again this year. So we've got some good guests lined up. Appreciate you being with us. And I'm not sure if we're having a little, maybe having a few technical problems here. Once again, I appreciate you tuning in. Anyway, you'll have to bear with me. My voice is a little off tonight. I'm fighting a cold, so hopefully we won't have any major problems there, but I'll sound a little bit different. Like I said, John Harris will be our first guest of Tennessee Firearms Association. And, you know, here in Tennessee, a red state, definitely a pro-Second Amendment state, I think sometimes we take for granted that, you know, our rights to keep and bear arms will always be there. They'll never, that there's not a threat, but yeah, that's just not the case. You certainly can't trust the federal government on that issue, and you can't fully trust our state government on that issue. You know, we'll talk about that a little more when we get with John, but one of the things that the arguments with what was normally called the parking lot bill, one of the issues was, people were saying, well, you know, this is a private property issue. You know, this is in reference to businesses that did not want to allow their employees to have weapons on their property. We're not talking about employees carrying their weapons into their place of business. We're just talking about them transferring them in their vehicle from home to work and back just so that they could protect themselves in between. And, you know, it took a little while to get that through, and it did get through, but there were some complications with it. You don't necessarily – it didn't really provide the protections that you thought it may have provided. So we're going to talk with him about that here in a little bit as soon as he gets on with us. And you may be surprised at some of the things that you find out about this issue. And so he should be with us here in just a second. And we're waiting for him. I think he's about popped up here. Let me see. Still, give me just a second here. Okay. Now, one of the things in reference to gun rights, I don't know if you followed it or not, but if you saw what's happening up in New York, and I understand we're not New York, but they're actually, I'm starting to read about some confiscation issues up there in New York. And, of course, we know anywhere around the city. We know if it's at the Bloomberg and actually the new mayor now as well. I mean, they are radical, radical anti-gunners. And, you know, let's remember, though, here in Tennessee, our current governor, when he was a mayor in Knoxville, he was originally a member of mayors against guns or mayors against gun violence or something like that. But it was a Bloomberg organization that he joined. Well, he did that as the mayor of Knoxville. And then, of course, when he decided to run for governor, somehow or another, he kind of disavowed that. And then he went out and joined the NRA to try to make himself sound like he was – make it look like he was a pro-gun guy. Had never been a member before, as I understand it. And interesting enough, I had a friend of mine who, when Governor Haslam was running the first time, he was at a fundraiser for Governor Haslam. And he was talking to him a little bit. And the guy was there, you know, I think he was invited by somebody else. He really was not that enthusiastic about Bill Haslam, but he got to talking to him. And the governor tried to make a big point out of guns, like, hey, you know, I just bought my grandson or my son a, you know, whatever type of shotgun that it was, trying to start small talk to make it sound like he was a gun guy. And, you know, my friend there, he could see right through it. You know, he knew that Haslam had been one of Bloomberg's mayors on this issue. And, you know, I was really surprised. I was disappointed. I thought that when it became common knowledge in Tennessee, which it did become before the election in 2010, that Haslam had been associated with the Bloomberg organization. I really thought, well, there's no way this guy can win. But I guess he had enough money to overcome. That's the only thing I can think of. So here we have a Bloomberg mayor elected as governor of Tennessee. Now, I'm sure he's a lifetime member now. He went ahead and, you know, pulled the $500 out of his small change drawer and paid his lifetime membership. You know, you have to wonder at that point in his life. First off, if you ever align yourself with somebody like Bloomberg, I think everybody would have to question how serious you are about, you know, your commitment to the right to keep and bear arms. This even here in Tennessee, we really have to pay attention. Just keep that in mind, you know. I mean, and he was not really all that wild about, like I say, what is normally known as the parking lot bill. He was not wild about that legislation. And I know that there's going to be an attempt to do something about that legislation, make some improvements to it in this session from some flaws that were left in the bill last year. So I'm curious to see how he reacts to that, see if he actually goes along with it, if he fights it tooth and nail. I believe the lieutenant governor will go along with it, but we'll see how that goes as well. He's got a good record overall, but, you know, money seems to talk really loud in politics, and Tennessee's no exception. So people that you think are true hardcore conservatives, Second Amendment people, you know, Bill of Rights people, sometimes when money gets, you know, the money starts flowing in politics, when big business starts talking, some of those people seem to listen to them, and it seems like their principles go out the window. That's unfortunately, you know, we're not immune from that here in Tennessee. So that is something we need to keep in mind. Hopefully we will get some more legislation passed. And, you know, I guess a bigger question is, here in the next few years as the federal government, we know they're going to make a push to kind of restrict gun rights. We know they're going to do it more and more. I mean, if you look with what the EPA, they're doing it backdoor, nothing else, with what the EPA did the other day, or Obama through the EPA, they closed down the last lead smelting plant in America. Doe Run, I believe it's in Arkansas. So now there's no other place in America that makes, that smelts, that, you know, processes lead for ammunition, which means everything, the lead's going to have to be imported. Well, it's going to be imported, which means that our federal government will be the first, those will be the first people that deal with it. Okay, so you can imagine the taxes and all the restrictions and red tape that you're going to have to go through just to get lead to, for the manufacturers to even create a bullet. So kind of a backdoor gun control method that they're going to use there. So I'm hoping that the leadership here in Tennessee will step up to the plate on this issue, and that they, you know, regardless of what the federal government does, you know, that at some point in time they will draw that line. And I guess we'll just have to find out if they really, you know, if they are committed to the right to keep and bear arms or not. And we will find that out probably in the not-too-distant future. So pay attention to that. Pay attention, you know, with politicians, you really – what they say doesn't mean a whole lot. You have to watch and see what they do, because that will tell you the truth about them, and especially when there's a lot of pressure put on them by special interest groups in deep pocket. And don't get me wrong, you're never going to get the money out of politics. And it's not so much that money is not necessarily the problem. It's the people with lack of principle. You know, it would take money in an election to get a good person, get the right person elected that nobody knows. Well, how else are you going to get them known? It's going to take money. I don't care if the guy goes door to door. Not the best way to do it, but if he wants to goes door to door in state or in his district to campaign, guess what? He needs money to put in his car. To get, you know, he needs money for gas. He needs money for food. You know, unless he's independently wealthy, he's got to, you know, still work or whatever. So it takes money no matter what. So you never get the money out of politics. But we have to be careful and watch what they do, and you know, hear what they say, watch what they do. Trust and verify, I guess, is another way of looking at it. Anyway, I know it's something that all conservatives are concerned about. And speaking of conservatives, all of us in Conservative Nation Media are proud to bring you our second annual Christmas Eve Music and Kids Extravaganza special on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, starting at 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Central on Christmas Eve. You can listen to hours of great traditional Christmas music live or download it to listen when you need to be reminded of the true glory and meaning of Christmas. And you can only get it from our website, conservativenationmedia.com. And don't forget to have your kids write Santa a letter from our website, or go to Santa Claus at conservativenationmedia.com, and Santa will send a personalized email back within 48 hours. From all of us at Conservative Nation Media to all of you, the warmest and most joyous Merry Christmas, and thanks for listening. You're listening to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176. Once again, still waiting on our first guest to arrive. Hopefully we'll hear from him soon. Otherwise, you'll be stuck with me for the next 40 minutes as I kind of plug the hole a little bit on this issue. But if anybody's out there that wants to talk about the issue of gun rights in Tennessee, you know, or just gun rights in general, Second Amendment in general, you give us a call, 718-305-7176. We'll, you know, the bottom line is with the Second Amendment, and the reason we have it, as most of you know, if you're listening to the show, you're conservative, and you're probably at least somewhat familiar with our history as a country. It's the last line of defense. It's the armed citizen to protect themselves from a tyrannical government, which, you know, it is certainly not out of the realm anymore that we might actually have to do that. I'm not advocating it. I'm just saying that it's not out of the realm of possibilities with the way things are headed. And in the meantime, you know, it's also there for the person just for self-defense. You know, you have a right to self-defense, life, liberty, property. And so the first thing, you know, if you can't protect yourself and defend yourself from all the bad guys out there, if you can't, you know, if you don't have a means of protecting your family, you know, I mean, that you're not in a free country if you don't have the ability to do that. And so it's very important that we maintain that freedom and that we pay attention to what's going on and not just trust our politicians. Just remember, whether you're talking state level or federal, our country, our state, they are too important to trust to the politicians. You know, we have to watch them. You have to watch them, you know, like a hawk. And, you know, don't trust them any further than you can throw them. You know, there are some good ones out there, but, hey, they're the exception and not the rule. So we just really have to keep an eye on them. All right, it's time to take a quick break, and don't go away. Hopefully we'll have John Harris with us right on the other side of the break. You're listening Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. Welcome back to Inside Tennessee and Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176. And apparently we're having some technical issues. People are having trouble hearing the commercials, myself included. So I don't know what the problem is. Hopefully we'll get that worked out. Once again, we're waiting on our host, our first guest, John Harrison, Tennessee Firearms Association. We got some specific things we want to talk to him about. But let's, in the meantime, we'll just talk in general about the right to keep and bear arms, about the Second Amendment, about self-defense, and about, you know, how important it is. I mean, can you imagine, as bad as things have gotten over the last few years in this country, if we didn't have a Second Amendment? You know, if we were already an unarmed country, I mean, where would we be today? What would we have? This current administration does what it wants. You know, if it can't get legislation that it wants passed in Congress, it just does an executive order, and nothing happens. Some in Congress might complain a little bit. They might say, you know, abuse of power, but nobody does anything. And nobody does anything at state level. You know, the governors, not that I expect ours would ever. I mean, he should, but I don't have any delusions about the guy. Should stand up, but that's not happening. I mean, to the credit of some, several states, you know, 20-some states, I think 26 or 27, did file the suit on Obamacare. So in some sense, they're standing up, but they're not standing up as firmly as they need to stand up. You know, the bottom line is, if the states don't stand up, then you eventually have nothing. You have no option but the people in the Second Amendment. You know, so, and this is something that some of you that know me have heard me say, it will be 10 or it will be 2. 10th Amendment. If states stand up and do the right thing, then, you know, the people will not be put in that position where they feel like they have no other option but to defend themselves. So that's how important it is. You know, the states really need to step up to the plate and put the federal government in check on all these different things that are going on, you know, all their many abuses of power. It's up to the state. Now, for so long now, we've been used to, and the states have been used to, just complaining about the federal government and then saying, well, there's nothing we can do about it. It's the federal government. Well, that's not acceptable. That's not the way we were designed. And to allow that to continue is just to allow tyranny. And that's what we're seeing right now. It's a soft tyranny at this point. It's getting a little harder every day out there, I believe, and getting a little more dangerous every day. So the States have to stand up, but states will not stand up if the citizens don't demand it. You know, when you no longer allow your state representative to pass the buck and say, well, you know, there's nothing I can do about it, the feds have said we have to do this, or, you know, the Supreme Court says. Well, you know, the Supreme Court, that is one branch of our federal government that it has totally gotten out of control. It was never intended to have the power that it has. Yes, it's supreme, but it was never intended to, you know, as an entity that's supposed to, was going to legislate from the bench. It was never intended to lead societal evolution based on a liberal agenda. It was there to just look at the constitutionality of a law. That's what it's for. And if the Congress disagreed with something, you know, they had the ability to, as a matter of fact, they still have it. If you look at Article 3, Section 2 of our U.S. Constitution, it lays out that the Supreme Court has primary jurisdiction on certain matters. Two states are involved in a lawsuit. Okay, Supreme Court, they're going to have the primary jurisdiction. Anything involving ambassadors, other, you know, certain maritime issues, it has the primary jurisdiction. It has appellate jurisdiction in everything else, meaning that it's not the first court you go to. You go through the appeals process, and it eventually can make it. It has appellate jurisdiction, but it also lays out that Congress can adjust that appellate jurisdiction. They can decide, well, hey, you know what? We're gonna pass some legislation, and we don't want the Supreme Court to have anything to say about it. And they can do that. They've done that as recently as the 1990s. They did it on prison reform issues. I don't remember the cases right off the top of my head. But if you remember, you know, there's been an issue a long time with federal prisons, issues of overcrowding and the rights the prisoners have, blah, blah, blah. And there was some legislation that the Congress was going to pass back in the 90s, and they anticipated that there would be federal court challenges. They took it out of the purview of the Supreme Court. They said, hey, look, we're going to limit you. Well, they have that power. They have used it. They need to use it on a lot of other things, really. But the bottom line is you've got to elect people that have conviction. You've got to elect people that have courage, that are not up there just to set themselves up for life and just to be necessarily popular. I mean, obviously, you got to have a certain amount of popularity to get reelected, but, you know, that popularity should stem from your performance and you being somebody who stands up for what's right and not a get along to go along type. But that is something that the Congress has. By the way, just as a reminder, the Supreme Court and the lower federal courts, they're a creation of Congress. Okay. All the different districts, all the different federal court districts, those are not in the Constitution. Okay. The Congress could decide, you know what, we're just going to have, you know, we're going to add or we're going to subtract the different federal court districts. That's all up to them. Or how many people are appointed. You know, there's no set number in the Supreme Court. So it is a creation of Congress. I think one reason, you know, that's not something that they want us to know about, because if everybody knew, hey, look, Congress, you could take care of a lot of the problems that have been created by the Supreme Court. Well, they don't want that pressure. They'd much rather be able to say that, well, we can't do anything about it. And that, you know, it's up to the Supreme Court and that our hands are tied. They want everybody to believe that. Okay, I'm having some sort of technical problem here because I'm getting a text here from our guest as he's been holding for 15 minutes, but I don't see him popping up here in the studio. So let me see what I can do here and take it from there. Hopefully we'll get this straightened out in a second. Because I'm not seeing him pop up in the the queue here. And I checked my mic right before. Everything was good. And my mute button is not on. So I apologize for everybody, and I apologize to John. So I don't know what the problem is here, why I can't hear him, and why he's not popping up in the studio. But we will see. And all right, we've got a couple minutes here till the break. And I will have to try to figure out on break what the problem is. I'm going to text him real quick, and then hopefully we'll get a response, and I can figure out. This has been on hold for 15 minutes, but I can't hear him. I can't see him pop up. Anyway, as I was saying a minute ago, that is a power that the Congress has. That's a power that we need to hold them accountable for at the federal level. At the state level, we need to demand that our state representatives, our state senators, our governor, stand up to the federal government when there's an abuse of power. We can't allow them to just blow it off and say there's nothing I can do. No, you took an oath to the Constitution, and if they're violating the Constitution, it's your duty to stand up and demand that, you know, they follow the rules that the rest of us have to follow. But that takes persistence on our part. It takes paying attention to what's going on, and unfortunately that's a commitment that not enough people seem to make anymore. Okay, listening on two lines. All right, I don't know what the problem is here. Okay. Okay, hold on here just a sec. Okay. I don't know what the problem. Okay. You're not showing up in the queue, John. I don't know what the problem is. You're not showing up in the queue. I'm going to try to figure this out over the break. And it's not the chat. Okay, well, let me try it again here. Okay, it. Let me try the bottom top to call. Bottom up top to call. Button on top. Okay. All right, we're going to. All right. Let's see if we can pull John up on this phone number here, and maybe we can get this squared away. Okay, it's dialing, but I don't see anything popping up here. All right. Well, folks, I don't know what the problem is. We're going to take a break. I don't know if you'll be able to hear the break or not. But don't go away. I apologize for the problems. I have no idea what the source of the problems are. But I'm going to take a quick break here, and hopefully we'll have everything worked out after the break. still. All right, welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. Phone number is 718-305-7176. A lot of good that'll do you. We're having some technical issues right now with our callers. I don't know if I'll be able to get this thing fixed or not. I will do my best. I have tried to call the guest, and we'll try yet again to do that. And I have no idea what the source of the problem is. Let me try it again here and see. Call a guest. Try it yet again. Here we go. All right. Okay, dialing, it says. Let's try it here. Getting nothing on that. Okay. What? Once again, for the listeners out there, I apologize. I have no idea what the problem is. Apparently he can hear me, but I can't hear him. People in the chat room can hear me, but I can't hear the commercials either. So I don't know what the problem is. All right. Well, gosh. All right, well, I guess we'll go back to the, just do what I can to try and muddle through this. Hopefully this show will come up and before we get too far along, any further along that is. I really apologize. Maybe at bottom of the queue, let's look at this. Okay. This is really frustrating for everybody. I'm sorry that we're having these problems here. All right, if you bear with me, I'm going to log off and log back on. And hopefully that will take care of the problem. So if you stand by, I'll be with you in just a minute. Let's try another number here. Anyway, as I was saying before, we have to be vigilant about these kind of things in regards to our Second Amendment rights. We have to demand our state stand up. We have to demand our Congress stand up. And we have to be very careful about who we put in there and have to watch them like a hawk once we put them in there. And you can't just elect people and then turn your mind off and then come back in 4 years, 2 years or 4 years and see how they're doing. You have to watch them. And, you know, that's a lot easier to do today than it used to be. I mean, the Internet, their record is up there instantly. So, you know, you have a way to keep tabs with them, tabs on them now that we did not used to have. Okay. Well, all right, folks, I can't really conduct business like this. I am going to log off. I'm going to log back on and open chat room back up, and we'll see how that goes. If that does not work, then I guess we're out of business for the night. So if you give me just a minute here, we'll try it. John, can you hear me?
Yes.
Finally. Oh, Lord. I don't know what to tell you. I have no idea what the problem is, but I'm glad you're with us. I appreciate your patience. Wow. Okay. All right. We've lost so much time, but what I want to do is I want to go ahead and turn it over to you. I'm going to hit you with some questions real quick, and then we'll take it from there, okay? Are you there? Can you hear me?
Hello?
Johnny? Okay. All right. Hey, we've lost so much time here. We're not going to have time to do the job I would like to do, but I want to go ahead and get into it and get as much as we can. And I will just have to get you back on, and I apologize. I have no idea what the problem is. I guess it's just the nature of Internet radio. Let's talk a little bit about the parking lot bill from last year. The disconnect between what the supporters of it – now, you guys – Tennessee Fire Association initially supported the legislation – but the specific bill that the Lieutenant Governor and others were pushing last year, you had some problems with from the onset, and there was apparently a disconnect between what they were telling us and what we ended up with. You want to hit that a little bit?
Oh, yes. Can you hear me fine?
I can hear you loud and clear now.
Very good. Very good. Well, thanks for getting me on tonight, and I'll certainly be glad to come back. I know the technical problems aren't anything that are easy to deal with. But here's the issue. The TFA has pushed what we call safe commute legislation for a number of years. And that concept focuses on two considerations. One is that an individual has a private property interest in the vehicle that they own or possess. So you own the car, and the contents of the car should be yours to control and dictate, so long as you legally own or possess the vehicle and the stuff in it.
Right.
The other thing that we've been concerned about is that an employer, predominantly these are employers we're talking about, should not have the capacity without assuming liability for effectively disarming an employee going to and from work and frankly about most of their daily affairs, because a lot of people go to the store, pick up their kids, do whatever they're going to do, either going to or coming from work. And so TFA has pushed for a number of years this safe commute concept because current law allowed or permitted an individual to be both criminally prosecuted and terminated for cause if they had a permit and an employer had a no weapons policy that included the parking lot. We pushed for that for a number of years, and in fact, the recent episode spans a window of 5 years. And in the preceding 4 years, our biggest opposition was primarily big business, Federal Express, the Chamber of Commerce, and other organizations that have found a lot of favor with the establishment Republicans, particularly since the establishment Republicans repealed the election laws that restricted corporate campaign contributions. So they sort of opened the floodgates and then they aligned with them. So what happened this year was very unfortunate. Lieutenant Governor Ramsey announced that he was going to carry the parking lot bill himself. He did so. He refused to let TFA even look at the drafts of the legislation before he put it in. Unfortunately, the legislation had the blind allegiance of the NRA's lobbyists. And then this bill comes and hits the floor. And we're told by friendly legislators that Ramsey and Harwell had told the caucuses that the bills were going to the floor as is without any amendments. And the problems with the bill are numerous. And for example, Ramsey kept making the statement publicly to the news media and on video that the bill, the legislation, would protect employees by not allowing employers to fire them if they had a permit and they parked their car in the parking lot in compliance with the law. Jeremy Faison, the House sponsor, testified in response to questions in House hearings that just the opposite. The bill would not affect in any fashion the ability of an employer to have an employment policy that prohibited firearms, that all this was intended to do was to eliminate the risk of criminal prosecution. So we got two sponsors running a bill. They don't even agree on what it does. And then the bill itself, as it's written, has a whole host of very particularized language that creates all kinds of loopholes. For example, as written, it would not apply if you're in a car or a vehicle that you're not an owner of. So if your name is not on the title, if your spouse's name's on the title, your parents' name's on the title, it's a loaner car, it's a lease car, it's a borrowed car, or if you're carpooling, you have your permit, you could be criminally prosecuted and lose your job under this bill, under this law, because it's poorly written. And there are other problems with it, like, for example, if your act of getting out of the car and putting your weapon in the trunk or the glove compartment is observable, either by another individual or, according to the Attorney General, even a security camera, you violate the law and you don't get the protections. And the real telltale sign that this was a complete sellout by our Republican leadership came when Ramsey's bill was introduced and all the big businesses and the Chamber of Commerce that had opposed it viciously in the preceding years suddenly weren't up there talking about it at all. So, you know, the law is a travesty, and we actually advise people with handgun permits, don't rely on it. Do not assume that your job is being protected if you get caught. Don't assume you won't be criminally prosecuted if you get caught, because under his law, which was largely a sellout to big business, you're going to get exposed to the risk of prosecution.
So, yeah, now, but you guys brought these issues up before the bill. I mean, it was not at the last minute when you guys brought your concerns up.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
You brought it up early on.
We emailed every legislator in writing a detailed list of why the bill was of concern to us, specifically the flaws we saw in the bill, suggested changes to the bill. And every legislator that voted on this law, either in a committee or on the floor, had been warned in advance in writing what the risks were. In addition, we were able to get two legislators, one a Republican and one a Democrat, to offer 13 or so amendments on the House floor that the House Majority Leader, Gerald McCormick, went around and tabled without ever having debate on them. And those amendments were specifically written with the intent of amending Ramsey's legislation to fix these problems. So not only did they have written notice of the flaws in the bill and how to fix them, we actually wrote the amendments and had them introduced, and they refused to even vote on them.
Oh, man. So, and that, you know, earlier before you had you on, I was talking about, you know, here even in Tennessee, you know, red state that it may be, you cannot necessarily trust the leadership to stand up for the Second Amendment. You know, mentioned that we have a former Bloomberg governor as our governor, and, you know, disappointingly, it seems like the lieutenant governor wasn't necessarily above board on this one either.
Oh, no, that is that goes without doubt, because, you know, after this bill was enacted, almost immediately a written request was made to the Attorney General for what's the effect of the bill. And there's a long Attorney General's opinion, it's a public record, that almost mirrors in substance the exact flaws that we raised and told them about, and they blindly ignored. And we've been told repeatedly by legislators who were not in leadership that they were concerned about the problems, that they realized there were problems, and that they were essentially admonished in caucus meetings, which are not publicly viewable, that they were going to pass this law whether they liked it or not, because it's what Ramsey wanted. And it was going to be passed without amendments, because that's what Ramsey wanted.
Now, this caucus you mentioned, now are minutes of that meeting available?
My understanding is they're not. Typically, those caucus meetings are held privately. They're not open to the public. public members and sometimes the news are invited, but that's usually a choreographed show and tell. It's not the intent that those meetings be regularly observed by the citizens of the state. And, you know, and that's a problem that the citizens have now, is with supermajorities in the Republican Party in both houses, there's not really open meetings in Tennessee where the citizens have an opportunity to see the business of government, because the Republicans under Harwell and Ramsey can go into these caucus meetings. They can decide what's going to happen in the caucus meetings, and then they can come out with short, brief, choreographed votes, just like they did on Ramsey's parking lot bill, so that the citizens really don't get a chance to see the debate over the bill, the flaws of the bill, who's really for it and who's really against it, because, frankly, a lot of the rank and file are just beaten into submission and told what to do, as opposed to accepting the fact that they're stewards and each of them represent approximately the same number of citizens.
So let me ask you this. What's going to happen with this bill next year? I mean, I've heard something that I saw in the paper where Ramsey was going to bring this bill back up. Is that just talk, or are you pretty confident that they'll not only bring it up but do the right thing with it?
Well, I'm confident that they may bring it up, and I'm confident if they do, and if it's under Ramsey's control, they won't do the right thing with it. Because I believe firmly, based upon the inferences and the evidence that developed over the last 5 years, that Ramsey pushed this through acting at the instruction of big corporate interests and the state's colleges, particularly UT and Vanderbilt, and the Chamber of Commerce.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Those were the main players that opposed the bill in the preceding 4 years. And when you look at a player like Federal Express and Amazon and Volkswagen, you know, it's hard for citizens to raise the money that those kind of people can grease into legislative access. Now, those big entities don't vote, but apparently that doesn't matter as long as they're giving those legislative incumbents the money that they want and the opportunities that they want to get reelected and maintain power and control. And that's really a crisis and a fundamental flaw that we have when legislators are so comfortable about being reelected that they're no longer stewards, but they're mainly protectors of their own power.
But that says a lot about the electorate too. I mean, you talk about a short memory. In a pro-gun state like this, that they feel that they can confidently do something like that and get away with it. And apparently we do have short memories, because what's the reelection rate? I know it's 95-96% at the federal level. I'm not sure what it is at the state level, but I'm sure it's close.
Yeah, it's pretty high. And, you know, that's the lesson we learned from Deborah Magert's destruction in 2012. Magert was the number three member of leadership in the House, and she, basically told the grassroots firearms interest, we don't need you. Matter of fact, you need us more than we need you, and you better do what we like and play along. And you know, across this state, House primaries at the state level, they can usually be run for $5,000, $10,000, maybe $20,000 or $30,000 in a primary. And TFA and other organizations across the state targeted Deborah Magert, and we ran Courtney Rogers up in District 45 as a challenger in the primary. And if you look at the PAC reports through last year, where the normal races, you know, we're talking less than $50,000, sometimes less than $20,000 are the budgets. That one race, over $300,000 was spent supporting Rogers, and almost $400,000 was spent by big business and big Republic like Ramsey, Haslam, and Harwell, who campaigned personally in that district to protect that seat that Magert held. So we spent, you know, almost, if not near, $700,000 on one little House race. It had, I think, 14,000 or 15,000 votes in the primary total.
Wow, that is a lot of money for a state House race.
Well,
that's something
you know, that's
you might hear out in California, maybe.
oh, yeah, that's ridiculous to spend that kind of money in Tennessee. But that's just an indicator of how much money is being manipulated by the leadership of the GOP to protect and maintain their control of people like Alexander, Corker, Haslam, Ramsey, Harwell. They're all cut from the same cloth. They're not about the Constitution. You know, they're about protecting the interests of big business in Tennessee.
Yeah.
Because you look at what they're doing since they've, you know, taken outside the Second Amendment issue. They have successfully attacked our Seventh Amendment rights to jury trials. They have capped damages. They have limited the discretion of juries. They have put mandates on judges to do things that they shouldn't be required to do. They have destroyed the financial viability of a lot of phone co-ops by appeasing AT&T by rate making, which is not a Republican platform in any shape, form, or fashion. You know, and the list is enormous, that when they changed the voting regs to allow corporate contributions to PACs and individual campaigns, you know, they did things that were intentionally designed to appease big business and to make their probability of successful dominion over the state more likely.
Let me ask you this. One of the things that you brought up was the capped damages for jury trials.
Right.
I mean, I think a lot of times that whole thing is abused. I think, you know, especially if you're talking medical malpractice, that's one of the things. Some states are worse than others. Mississippi, I know they have a problem keeping doctors. West Virginia is another state that has a high, you know, pretty much if it goes to trial, the doctor is going to lose, and you're going to have this huge amount awarded. And I'm not saying that that's never justifiable, but I mean there is an issue, there is a problem there with.
There is an issue. There's not a problem, and here's where that issue comes up in other states as well. And frankly, in some states where their Supreme Courts have looked at it, those capping statutes and those protection statutes have been struck down as unconstitutional. And one reason is they violate the fundamental principle of separation of powers. They operate on the theory that the entire third of government, the judicial branch, is fundamentally incompetent to grant and have a review process for jury awards. Because in Tennessee and in most other states, you go in front of a jury with a medical malpractice claim or an automobile claim or whatever kind of injury claim, the jury is charged that they are the finders of the facts, and those 12 peers or those 12 people have to determine, based on the instructions that the judge gives them as to the law, what a reasonable amount of damages would be if they find a violation. And then, get this, they go off and they deliberate and they come back and render a verdict. If the judge, who is a trained in the law and in constitutional law, finds that the jury's verdict is excessive or unreasonable under the facts, that judge, the trial court judge, can grant what's called a remittitor or a new trial. A remittitor reduces the damages and enters them at a lower level subject to the acceptance of the prevailing party. And the new trial just says you get a complete do-over. The trial was unfair. If that judge refuses to do either of those two things, then the case can be appealed to an appellate panel of three judges. And it's a mandatory review, and they get to then ask that three-judge panel to review the facts that were presented to the jury, and one of the things they have to review is whether or not the jury's judgment was excessive or unreasonable under the facts before them.
So there's already a system of checks and balances is what you're telling me.
Oh, yes, and it's a very strong system, and to believe that those 132 legislators acting with no substantive facts in front of them can craft an arbitrary number that fairly applies in all instances to impair a constitutional right, the Seventh Amendment, is an abuse of authority. And that's why courts in other states are striking them down as unconstitutional.
You know, when you just when you said that, you know, one of the things that I'm reminded of when we go up there and we take information to legislators on different things, and I know you've heard this as well, these guys are really busy. You know, there's, what, 2,000 bills per session. There's
yeah.
no way they know a lot about the majority of those bills. And if they're not on that committee, they know really next to nothing. And so I think that kind of lends credence to what you're saying, because they've already told us, look, I don't have enough time to fully understand all the issues I'm going to vote on just by the volume of stuff that they get hit with and just by the nature of the committees up there. Hey, you know, obviously you're going to focus on the issues that fall under the committee. That your committee or committees that you're on. So, but yet, like you say, in this case, they would be making a judgment on something that, once again, they would not have had a whole lot of time to, you know, do the study on and make arbitrary judgments on it. So I hadn't thought about it that way. It's still a little leery. I think sometimes we go overboard. But I was not aware that Tennessee had all those protections. And that may not be the same in other states. I don't know.
In some states, it would be different. Yeah,
have a little change in the program here. Representative Wirgo is not going to be with us tonight. He is going to be on the show next week. So, John, we do have a little more time. I've got to take a break now. Hopefully the break will work. Hopefully everything will work coming back from the break. If you could stay with us for another 15, 20 minutes, is that feasible?
Oh, yeah, I'll stay as long as you want me.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. All right, I'm going to try this break, and hopefully everything doesn't go away when I do this. You're listening to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. We'll be right back. Okay, once again, I hear no music. Good Lord. Okay, I'm being told that not only can I not hear the music, nobody else can hear it either. So what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and start back over. This is Inside Tennessee Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. Phone number is 718-305-7176. And we are talking to John Harris, the president of the Tennessee Firearms Association. So far we've covered the issue of the bill commonly known as the parking lot bill, which was, I think, known as the safe commute bill. And we'll see if that is actually brought back up again next year. And we were just talking a little bit about the situation here in Tennessee with the different committees, and John enlightened me a little bit on the whole that we don't necessarily need the legislature here in Tennessee setting caps on jury awards. John, if you could maybe go into a little bit of detail on the difference between constitutional arms as opposed to the Second Amendment.
Sure, sure. You know, we hear frequently people talk about Second Amendment rights and the Second Amendment weapons. And I frankly think, and I've come to the conclusion over the years, that we really, from an understanding perspective, have used the wrong terminology. The Second Amendment was put in place by the founders to deal with the fact that weapons in the Revolutionary War period that England focused on were military-grade weapons owned by civilians that were of equal or substantially equal quality to what the military carried when England came over and tried to suppress, you know, the revolutionaries. And we hear this terminology bannered about on the Internet and in the news media about Second Amendment weapons and Second Amendment rights. And we need to understand that the Second Amendment doesn't create any rights. It exists solely as a declaration and a prohibition against government from infringing the pre-existing right of the citizens to own weapons. And Second Amendment weapons, you know, I deal a lot in my law practice with the ATF. And dealing with the ATF, and frankly dealing with a lot of legislators, we run into this mindset that the Second Amendment protects weapons that have sporting purposes, according to the ATF. And if you talk to legislators on the campaigns, a lot of them will talk to you about Second Amendment and how that's important to preserve our interest in hunting and recreationally shooting and having a self-defense pistol. But legislators will quickly shy away from anything more than that. And that's why it's critical for people to understand that constitutional arms, Second Amendment arms, are not the deer rifle, the duck hunting shotgun, the sporting clay shotgun, or really even your self-defense handguns. Those are all within the scope of the Second Amendment. But it's critical to go back and realize that at the time it was written, the arms that were being protected from government infringement were those necessary to the civilian ownership should the need ever arise politically to overthrow the government and the government's army, which means their military-grade weapons. And that is a concept that's fully reflected in two Tennessee Supreme Court decisions from the 1800s. One's called Andrews and the other's called Amet, but both of which stand for the principle that the weapons that the citizens have a guaranteed right to own under both the Tennessee and the United States Constitutions were military-grade weapons, and not military weapons of the 1700s, but modern military weapons. And then we have this case that comes along in the 1930s in the federal level called Miller. And under this Miller decision, a couple of guys had been prosecuted because at that time the federal government had passed the National Firearms Act and they regulated the ownership by civilians because they knew they couldn't ban it. That's clearly reflected in the legislative history. But they taxed the transfer among civilians of machine guns, short barrel rifles, short barrel shotguns, and then what they generally classified as destructive devices. And this case called Miller goes up to all the way to the United States Supreme Court on the theory that two men in possession of an unregistered, read that as untaxed, sawed-off shotgun could be federally prosecuted with the crime of possession of an unregistered weapon. Now, it's important to understand that the trial court had agreed and said the Second Amendment protects that gun, the short barrel shotgun, because it's a military grade weapon, and dismissed the charge. The appellate court, the intermediate appellate court at the federal level, agreed and dismissed the charge. This thing goes all the way to the United States Supreme Court in the 1939. The only person to file a brief in the United States Supreme Court in Miller was the United States Department of Justice. The two guys that had the gun were long gone. The Supreme Court did this in Miller. The Supreme Court said, there's not enough evidence in front of us to determine whether the sawed-off shotgun is the kind of weapon being used by our military. That's critical. So we're going to send the case back for a determination of whether the shotgun, the sawed-off shotgun, was used by the military. And it's important to understand, by phrasing the question that way, the court was focusing on the issue of the modern military using that kind of weapon. Because otherwise, it could have simply said, if it was, if that element wasn't critical, we're going to send it back to determine if this weapon is an arm or something else. But by linking it to the modern military, they were recognizing the true purpose of the Second Amendment. It's also critical to understand that in the brief filed by the Department of Justice in 1939, this is huge, the Department of Justice, before the era of political correctness, concedes that the Second Amendment exists to protect weapons suitable for civilian military use. Their argument was that the civilian military, the modern military, didn't use this kind of weapon. So that's why the court sent it back, to determine whether the military in the 1930s was using sawed-off shotguns. The inference being, if it was, if it could be shown that the military used that gun, the Second Amendment protected it. And that's why I say we need to talk about constitutional arms. Citizens have the fundamental right, protected by the Second Amendment, to own weapons suitable and necessary for military use today.
Now, let me ask you something here.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, now what about just, okay, so they sent it back to basically judge it against the standard of does the military use it? And if the answer is no, then I guess they could say that it's okay, then it's not covered. But what about just for self-defense? I understand that the Second Amendment is about more than self-defense, but does that mean that would that not be an adequate reason to be able
well,
to
Well, see, that's
it?
What came up in the old Tennessee cases. One of them was like a derringer, and the Tennessee court said, well, clearly the soldiers don't use derringers. Well, some do. You know, we got special ops that use all kinds of things. And that's why I say those kinds of guns, what we consider personal sporting arms or personal protection guns, most people concede that those are covered by the Second Amendment, that believe in the Second Amendment. Where the real battleground is what we call constitutional arms, the weapons of the modern soldier. Those are the
right
ones that even Second Amendment supporters think, well, reasonable people don't need machine guns. Well, that's exactly the opposite of what our founders said, because our founders were saying the citizens own the country, and if we get a government in place that's out of control, like happened in Athens, Tennessee in 1946,
yeah,
citizens cannot effectively stand up to National Guardsmen and U.S. military with machine guns and flamethrowers and bazookas, whatever the infantryman might carry, if all they've got is deer rifles and you know, duck hunting shotguns.
Right, right. Let me read this real quick, and then I've got a couple questions for you. ConservativeNationMedia.com is growing, and we couldn't think of a better way to expand our lineup than to give our very own Bing Fisher his very own show. Uncle Bing Fisher brings his engineer's insight and love of America to American by Design. Sunday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern, 5 Central on ConservativeNationMedia.com. So stay with Conservative Nation Media 7 days a week since we're making some big changes and we're just getting started. American by Design with Bing Fisher, Sundays at 6 Eastern, 5 Central on ConservativeNationMedia.com, where America always wins. You're listening to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. The phone number is 718-305-7176. John, we do have a caller on the line. We've got Kurt on the line. Let me see what question or comment he might have before we start over. All right, well, can't get him to pull up for some reason. Kurt, if you're listening, I'll try to pull you up again in a minute, but I can't catch you on for some reason. Anyway, okay, so let me ask you this, then. Having everything you've said about the Second Amendment initially being focused on the citizens being able to protect themselves against other armies, essentially. So translate that today. Where would you draw the line on what citizens can and cannot have?
You know, that's a great question because it's a natural follow-up. I think the first analysis is anything, any weapon that our foot soldiers are presently issued or allowed to carry on fields of battle anywhere in the world falls within the constitutional arms definition. Anything an individual foot soldier is armed with, issued, or can carry. And the real question becomes, what about arms that are more than an individual soldier could carry? What about the tank? You know, what about the other stuff, the howitzers
cannon
and whatnot? Yeah,
right.
Yeah, and
right.
If you look back at the Revolutionary War, and if you look at the Civil War, and if you actually go all the way back to our Constitution, there are ample examples of private citizens owning cannons and even warships. The merchant ships back in the Revolutionary War period could be constitutionally issued authority to go out and engage in battle. And so I think clearly the first line is, without a doubt, anything the foot soldier can be issued or that the foot soldier can use in battle, which clearly includes handguns, machine guns, subguns, a variety of things that the federal government essentially prohibits civilian ownership today by bans, restrictions, or taxes. And I think the more interesting question, though, is what do you do about owning a tank? And it's interesting because Senator Green came and talked with TFA back during the summer. He's from Clarksville area. And he
my senator.
Yeah. And Mark Green was in the military. And he was a ranger, a physician in the military. And he expressed the opinion, and I'm paraphrasing, that essentially private citizens should be able to acquire, to the extent they can afford it, any military-grade weapon that they wanted, including, you know, the modern equivalent of this battleship from the 1700s, which were, you know, basically merchant ships outfitted with cannons.
Okay. I mean, I'm fine with that. I was just curious, you know, where a line was drawn. And to be honest with you, with the way our government is headed today, I feel more comfortable in the hands of those weapons in the hands of a lot of the people that I know than I do under the control of our current administration. And that includes the cowards that run our state. So I was just curious. I wanted to, you know, as you say, I think
it's a fair question. For example, you know, nobody has any qualms at all with private civilian ownership of helicopters, but mount a minigun on one and see what kind of fit they'll throw.
In a heartbeat.
Okay.
In a heartbeat.
But, you know, if the citizens rose up, and I don't think it's practical to happen or likely to happen, but constitutionally the question is not practical, but what's our right to the extent that we as the citizens band together to displace a government that has turned into a tyrant? And we're not necessarily off that path at this point with Obama in control. I think our founding fathers would have been very comfortable with the idea that if you can acquire in private ownership a helicopter, you should be able to outfit it with a minigun.
I like it. I like it. I mean, I know I'm probably in the minority, but I like that. And, you know, and speaking of rights, and this is from and I'm sure you're very familiar with this, Article 1, Declaration of Rights from the Tennessee Constitution, that all power is inherent in the people and all free governments are founded on their authority and instituted for their peace, safety, and happiness, for the advancement of those ends they have at all times an unalienable and indefeasible right to alter, reform, or abolish the government in such a manner as they may think proper. So, you know, at the time when this document was created, you know, they were leery of centralized power, and they were leery of standing armies. So, you know, I think we probably wouldn't have a lot of things going on today that we do have going on if maybe we were a little better armed other than just with the small arms that we have. So, don't know that we're going to get through everything tonight. We kind of got shorted on time. I've got to take a break here. But until the next caller comes on, I'm going to hold you over if I can, but I am going to attempt to take one more break here. If you could stay with us, and we'll see if this commercial will work. If not, we'll talk a little longer. You're listening to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. Don't go away. Once again, nothing but silence. All right, John. Well, this, you know, this sometimes happens on internet radio. Anyway, okay, what has the Tennessee Supreme Court said on the constitutional issue? I think you touched that a little bit, but what's the current? I imagine the current Tennessee position kind of mirrors the federal position.
Oh, I think the there's really not been a good case get to the Tennessee Supreme Court since 1871, when the latter of the Andrews and Amonet cases got up there. And back then, before all this political correctness, you know, they were right on point, said essentially the Second Amendment stood for the proposition that military-grade weapons is what was protected, and the question that they were looking at, just like Miller, was whether or not the particular weapon in question was a military-grade weapon. You know, what we see out of our current court is sadly driven by a bunch of bad legislation that creates all these restrictions and thou shalt nots and, you know, statutory enactments that want to restrict, restrain, and deny access to guns by civilians. And they don't even there's not even a really good case on Article 1, Section 26, which is our state constitutional equivalent of the Second Amendment, which says that the citizens have a right to keep and bear arms, but the legislature shall have the power by law to regulate the wearing of arms. So there's no ability to regulate under our Constitution keeping or bearing arms. But they can regulate with a view towards crime prevention, wearing. Now, ask yourself this question just in that context. What and the Andrews case, the 1871 case says, it's not just that they can regulate the wearing. There's this qualifier with a view towards crime prevention. And the court said it's got to have a well-defined crime prevention purpose. So look at some of the statutes that our legislature puts in place and maintains completely oblivious to the constitutional restraints. Say, for example, no guns in park that they've allowed local governments to enact. What crime prevention purpose is there to keeping the average citizen disarmed in a public park? You know, no guns on school grounds. What crime is being prevented by declaring that the average citizen can't have their weapon with them when they're picking up or dropping off their kids or going to a sporting event? You know, there's no crime prevention purpose, and there's no legislative history on any of these statutes that creates or satisfies the Supreme Court's statement that there's got to be a well-defined crime prevention purpose. So I would submit to you that in that context, most of the gun restrictions that Tennessee has are likely unconstitutional if the court would strictly construe or impose the constitutional restraint.
So that constitutional restraint was never clearly defined after it was passed? Are there any old statutes that we can look at that would give us a better idea on that?
No, there's really not. In the last century, I think much of what has unfortunately driven public opinion has been a dumbing down in our education system, particularly over the last 50 years, and an expansive growth of this whole concept of political correctness and the nanny state. You know, the government needs to take care of us. It came about ever since, you know, the reforms of the 1930s. We just don't have a good body of case law from modern courts, although that's changing a little bit, taking the Constitution and giving it backbone and spine as it was intended. They get, I think, distracted sometimes with this reasonableness standard that really doesn't apply when you're talking about constitutional rights.
Now, what about let me ask you this. You've been up there at the legislature a lot, and in dealing with candidates and just politicians in general, how many of them do you think are with you on this, or at least in your neighborhood on this issue?
Oh, I think there's only a handful of them that are. Some of them I can identify. I think Senator Green understands what the Second Amendment's really about. I think some of the others that have served in the military really understand it. Now are they going to have the force of peers stand with them to make the changes that need to be changed? Not with the rhinos in charge. But I think it's clear that we've got some legislators that really do understand it and don't know what to do about it to get it back in place where it should be.
Well, now, 2014 is an election year, so candidates are going to be out there, and, this is probably something that those of us who take your position, and I agree with you, I hadn't really thought, to be honest with you, to the extent I wasn't necessarily in the same neighborhood as you are before tonight, but the more I think about it, the more I like it. But how do you bring this up to candidates? What's the best approach during an election year? Any advice you could give to people vetting candidates on this?
Yeah, and that's a topic I address frequently when I go do public speaking. I like to tell people that take the opportunity, whether you are a strong Second Amendment person, even if you don't really like guns personally, okay, that where a candidate is, honestly, on the Second Amendment and this concept of constitutional arms is probably one of the best litmus tests on how well they understand the constitutional framework more broadly, that they're going to be asked or that they're asking us to give them the opportunity to go up there and defend and protect and enforce. And if you've got a candidate or you've got an incumbent and their concept is, either I'm against the Second Amendment, I'm distant from the Second Amendment, or their concept is the Second Amendment's all about hunting and self-defense and sporting weapons, and they'll
right.
tell you things like, oh, citizens don't need to own machine guns. You don't have a need for that AR-15. Why would any real person think they've got to have an AK-47? If they don't grasp the political basis that the founders were on, when they adopted the Second Amendment, and when Tennessee's constitutional authors wrote Article 126, then can you really trust that candidate or that incumbent to go up there and zealously defend your right to a jury? The constitutional framework of separation of powers. Can you really trust them to stand up to the federal government under the 10th Amendment and say, you've gone too far, back down, or we're going to show you the force of our state and other states? And I submit to you that most of the problem, even to the federal level, is because we got too many legislators in too many states that don't understand the basic principles of the Constitution and the sovereignty of the states and the reason the Second Amendment exists to give the citizens the ultimate power, if we ever have to call upon it, over both the states and the federal government. And so I think if you got a good understanding of the concept of the Second Amendment, why it exists, its political purpose, and what constitutional arms are, in very few questions you can talk to a legislator or a candidate and figure out if they're on that page. And if they're not, you can push them. And if they keep trenching back into sporting purposes or hunting, you walk away from them, because I wouldn't trust them with the income tax issue, the abortion issue, the 10th Amendment issues, the jury trial issues. I wouldn't trust them with any of it. It's like these establishment Republicans we got right now, they're breaking their necks to try to get us tricked into voting this year on sacrificing our right as citizens to elect our judges.
Yeah.
They want to appoint them.
A lot of effort into that.
Yeah.
And I want to. That's something that kind of irritates me. I hear the excuse, well, we don't want judicial elections politicized. Why don't we want them? Why don't you want the people to have a vote?
That's exactly right. Listen, if the people are smart enough to elect a governor, and they're smart enough to elect a senator, and they're smart enough to elect a House member, why are we incompetent to elect a judge?
That's a good point. I don't have a problem with electing them. Number one, you got to follow the Constitution, and they're not following it, and they haven't followed it. When did they stop following that specific part of the Tennessee Constitution? I think that was, back in the 70s when they decided, we just don't really need to follow this part anymore. We'll have the governor appoint them. So,
right.
And they've gotten by with it for all those years now.
Well,
so
and that was a concept.
That's sad.
Yeah, that was a concept brought to us largely by the Democrat Party as they started to lose power, and they wanted to protect the capacity for controlling the judiciary as opposed to having popular elections for it. But, hey, we popularly elected our judges in this state for the first 170 years. Why did we suddenly lose that capacity?
And, of course, now the GOP is trying to keep it for pretty much the same reason. I guess it would be similar reasons.
Yeah, yeah. Well, think about it. If you're either in the governor's office or the General Assembly, and the only roadblock on your path to dominion and control is a Supreme Court and appellate courts that will slap your hands and say, no, the Constitution doesn't permit it, do you want those to be publicly elected public servants in the judiciary, the third branch of government, completely autonomous? Or do you want to appoint the people that serve over there so that you're beck and call?
That's a good point. Good point. And I think that hopefully that the people will stand up on that one. Hey, one of the worst nightmares that can befall an American today is identity theft. If it happens to you, it may take months or even longer to recover from it, if you can recover at all. Don't let it happen to you. Protect yourself in advance. Sign up today with LifeLock. LifeLock is a lot more than just your standard credit monitoring service. LifeLock helps to protect your personal information using a combination of data surveillance techniques and outstanding member service 24/7, 365. There's really nothing that comes close to LifeLock. To protect your identity with LifeLock and get 10% off their great service, go to conservativenationmedia.com and click on the LifeLock banner. Network may not cover all transactions, and the scope may vary. That's conservativenationmedia.com, and click on the LifeLock banner. You'll be very glad that you did. Don't go away. We are going to attempt to take another break. You're listening to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. Once again, flash, no bang. Okay, and I don't know where my next guest is. However, we are talking with John Harris from Tennessee Firearms Association. And, John, I will keep you as long as I can. Still got a few questions I'd like to go over with you if you've got time.
Sure, sure. I'll stay with you as long as you need me.
All right. Appreciate it. Okay. Now, the current – and we talked about this a little bit. And I talked – I don't know if you heard this, but earlier I was talking about – Haslam had been a Bloomberg mayor. I now consider him a Bloomberg governor. I mean, I don't trust the guy on this issue or anything else. And you had, as we mentioned earlier, the issue with the safe commute bill that had language that we knew was going to be problematic. We were told never mind, and we were also told apparently in a caucus meeting that, hey, this is what we're doing, and just get in line with it. So, how safe is the Second Amendment in Tennessee with the current hold that allegedly conservative Republicans have on the House and Senate?
Oh, I don't think it's safe at all. If I saw indicators, particularly coming out of leadership, that they were honoring their oath, first and foremost, to defend, uphold, and protect the Constitution, then we might feel better. But there's a number of elements about the current leadership that make me conclude that the Second Amendment is not safe in Tennessee under Republican control, particularly a Republican supermajority, when we have people like Haslam, Ramsey, and Harwell at the sitting on Mount Olympus as the leadership.
Let me ask you something. Would you have said that about Ron Ramsey 2 or 3 years ago? And granted, I know you've dealt with him a whole lot more than I have. I voted for him in 2010. I thought he was pretty much as conservative as they can get. I really thought he was a stand-up guy on this issue. Have you been kind of surprised the way it's played out?
Yes, I have been. Ron Ramsey is the first legislator and the only legislator before we got to Courtney Rogers that TFA had ever endorsed for anything. And we endorsed him in the Republican primary when he ran for governor against Haslam. I mean, we knew what Haslam was. He was a Bloomberg mayor. He was anti-gun, doesn't own a gun, doesn't care to own a gun, doesn't think others need to own guns. And he, when he decided to run for governor, he withdrew, like Dr. Seuss's Grinch That Stole Christmas from Bloomberg's, and became an NRA member suddenly. You know, he just tried to go out and buy pedigree with all that pilot money. And he came to TFA, and we've got him on videotape on YouTube at a Nashville meeting, where he promised that if the legislature would pass constitutional carry, which is citizens can carry arms, no permit required, that he would sign it. And I don't think he meant it when he said it. And he certainly, when he started backtracking over the next few days, had all kinds of qualifiers and excuses. But he's right there on video, no qualifications. If they'll pass it in the legislature, I'll sign it. And but Ramsey's done this. He sort of was one of the sponsors of the first handgun carry permit laws back in the 1996 time frame. You know, he's sort of been one of those reliable senators that if you could get it on the floor, he'd vote for it. And he wasn't bad as lieutenant governor. I had frequent access to his office. But Ramsey ran for governor. And Ramsey's, if you look back at the PAC reports, Ramsey's campaign spent about $3 million on his race for governor. And he found out that money's critical, because if you look at Haslam's reports, Haslam put over $3 million of his own money into his race. He matched Ron dollar for dollar out of his own pocket, and then he raised another $14 million on top of that. Haslam bought the governor's office in Tennessee, in my opinion, and Ramsey realized that and has become very focused on not the Constitution, which his oath calls him to put first, but on raising the money and the financial resources to maintain a political dynasty at this point.
Wow, that's sad. That's sad.
Now, and others may disagree, but you look at where he puts his time and his efforts, it's out raising money.
Well, you know, and here's what I don't quite understand. I mean, I really thought that in 2010 that Haslam's association with Bloomberg would have killed him just immediately in Tennessee. I really did. Obviously, that didn't happen. But I just also thought that, I mean, I did not follow state politics, really didn't start until 2010, okay? Maybe late 2009, but generally speaking, 2010 is when I really started paying much attention. I'd never heard the name Bill Haslam. Yeah, I mean, I knew about Pilot, but you would have thought that Ron Ramsey would have had a little better name recognition. He'd been around for a good while.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. And I think that's very true observation. But it reflected, and I think the conclusion that Ron drew was, and no matter how hard you've worked, and it don't matter how you voted, if the other guy can raise more money, he's going to win, unless something devastating happens to his public persona. And Haslam's got a good, you know, he's a likable guy if you're sitting around talking to him, and he succeeded well, and he dresses nice, and he raised a boatload of money, and he went all over the state on a regular basis, even though he was mayor of Knoxville. And I think he brought to the voters in this state this idea of, I'm a businessman, I'm a successful businessman, and Tennessee needs a businessman in the governor's office, so that we can be more efficient, reduce the size of government, and entice big business to come here and create jobs. And, you know, it's basically the Republican version of hope and change. And what he's done is he's brought us establishment Republican hope and change. You know, you hear the mantra, for example, jobs, jobs, jobs. But look at what kind of jobs they're bringing into Tennessee. It's Amazon warehouse jobs. It's factory jobs. They're not bringing in skilled jobs, high-paying jobs. They're making Tennessee an attractive place for big business to have cheap labor.
Yeah.
You know, we're
and
not
I'm
Silicon Valley.
Yeah, well, I know, and I'm curious to see if they will fight. I mean, I already know the question on the governor. I think this year before last, Joe Carr had some legislation dealing with illegal immigration. And, well, just kind of turns out there was no money in the budget for it. Haslam
yeah.
could not find money in his budget to deal with the illegal immigration issue. So these big companies are going to come in, and these low-skilled jobs, well, who are those jobs going to go to? They're going to go to illegal aliens, a lot of them,
right,
not all
right.
of them, but a good chunk of them.
Well, another example, another great example. Why is Haslam pushing Sharia law? It's not because it's a better system. It's because there's all kind of Islamic money behind it.
Now, you know, I had Ron Ramsey on a couple months ago, and I brought that issue up about it. Now, and he seemed to honestly be concerned about, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood stuff. And he seemed to be concerned about the stuff going on in the state. And, of course, if he was really concerned, then I think he could – he's got enough power. If he was really concerned, he could probably put his foot down and make some things happen. But, you know – one of the things, and I've heard it from him, I've heard it from others, I think Steve Gill was one of the other guys who poo-pooed this whole thing about, oh, Samar, she's a good old girl from Waverly. We don't have to worry. Well, wait a minute, hold on. This good old girl from Waverly worked at a Sharia-compliant bank in Amman, Jordan, okay? And a bank that when she went there was under investigation for funding terrorism. And she's an expert in Sharia-compliant finance. So even if she is not officially doing Sharia-compliant finance in her current position as the head of the International Division of Tennessee Economic Development, do you think that that her belief system and her past don't figure into who she's doing business with and what kind of businesses she'll bring here?
Well, you know, that's a great question in a rhetorical sense because we all know the answer to it. But consider this back on Ramsey. It's the feigned concern over an issue that's important to a segment of the population without conceding that he has the power really to do something about it. You know, when we understand in Tennessee that we have one of the weakest governors in the country because our legislature can pass a bill on a simple majority, 50% plus one vote in both houses. Send it to the governor. He can veto it. It comes back. If those same people vote on a veto override, 50% plus one, the governor's veto is overridden. We did it. The TFA did it twice on Bredesen. He vetoed bills. We had enough push to get the General Assembly to override the vetoes. Simple majorities is all it takes. If Ron Ramsey and Beth Harwell were really genuinely concerned about Sharia law infiltrating government in Tennessee, or even socioeconomic issues at the local levels. You know, what happens in our schools, what happens in our courts when demands are made for Sharia compliance. All it takes is 50% plus one, even if Bill Haslam's been bought and paid for with Sharia money. They can stop
That's
it.
A good point.
And they
That's a good
choose
point.
Not to. Because they can stop it.
Well, we just need more. We definitely need more true conservatives, and I guess we could use what they used to call paleocons. And speaking of paleocons, our friendly local pilot in command and GOP spokesman Duke Brooks calls himself a paleocon, and rightly so, since it's clear that anti-communism is in his DNA. His parents were friends with Joe McCarthy, Bill Buckley, and Whitaker Chambers, so what would you expect? There's no truth to the rumor that he has a dartboard with Alger Hiss's picture on it, but you can get your weekly dosage of old-school conservatism, right-wing politics, American history, and hangar flying radio on Radio Free America with Duke Brooks, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central on conservativenationmedia.com, where America always wins. You're listening to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176. And, John, I'm going to try to take a call here from Kurt. I don't know. Nothing has worked technically very well tonight, and it continues to not work very well. So, you know, we were talking a minute ago about the Islamist problem here, and it is a huge problem in this state. I mean, I think probably most of the listeners know this, but our Department of Public Safety, Bill Gibbons, and his sense of that, the DHS, Department of Homeland Security, the state portion of it, falls under him, and they have an arrangement, a partnership with the American Muslim Advisory Council. They have another organization, the American Center for Outreach, but it may sound, you know, it says American Center for Outreach, but what you're really talking is Islamist outreach, because they have a lobbyist full-time up in Nashville, okay? We already mentioned Samara Ali and her past ties. Her father is a doctor in Waverly, Tennessee, and he's been, I think, the president of the Tennessee Medical Association a couple times. I don't know if he currently is or not, but he's been linked to an organization called the Jerusalem Fund that has ties to Hamas. So, I mean, you've got all these things going on in our state, and a governor that, like I say, incompetent or in cahoots on this issue, and lieutenant governor that seems to realize there's a problem but hasn't put his foot down. So what do you think's gonna? I know your main issue is the Second Amendment, but I know you care about everything else going on in this state, this country. So what do you think's gonna happen in Tennessee on that issue, John?
You know, I think, you know, you look across the state and you look at Facebook, and there's all kinds of people in and out of the Tea Parties, the 9/12 groups at the grassroots level that are up in arms about Sharia influence in Tennessee, that are up in arms about Common Core, that are frustrated with other paths that the establishment leadership are on. On each of those paths, you can accept the fact that leadership, because of the weakness of our governor, could put a stop to it in the General Assembly almost overnight. And they refuse to do so. And you got to ask why. Do they not get it? Are they not listening? Or is the voice of the interested parties so muted by the overwhelming, deafening silence of an apathetic majority of voters that they don't care? They don't see it as something that's going to cost them their power positions if they continue to disregard us. And I think it's where a lot of it lies. You know, they don't feel a risk to their incumbency because not enough citizens are even aware this is going on.
They're counting on ignorance and apathy to basically keep them in power.
Yeah.
Well, that's sad, but I think there's unfortunately a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, I mean, you go around and talk to the local GOP parties. A lot of them are furious, but there's not enough participation in the local county parties to make a difference at the ballot box. Too many people just go into the ballot box and just party line vote.
Well, and, you know, that's another thing. The county parties don't have any power. You know, the SEC has all the power. And one of the things, and I'm no longer in the GOP. I don't think we've talked about this before, and I'm actually in the Constitution Party. And I'm speaking for myself. I'm not speaking on behalf of Inside Tennessee or Conservative Nation Media or anything else. But one of the things I like about the Constitution Party as constructed in Tennessee, the county chairs are going to be part of the Constitution Party's equivalent of the SEC. So you don't just have these, you know, 33 or these 66 men and women from the 33 Senate districts that have all the power and are, you know, usually influenced by people at the top of the food chain. You have the counties. They are all part of the picture. And I think, you know, if you're talking about, you know, grassroots, I think that's the way you have to go. But the current GOP chair at a county level, he has no power, none whatsoever. And so that's something that I don't think that just taking over the SEC will cure that problem.
No, I don't think it will either. I think one thing that gives us a glimmer of hope is we have seen some of the repercussions, ripples in the pond, so to speak, from what the grassroots groups did collectively from across the state in District 45 when their number three person, Maggart, was destroyed, essentially, in a primary after four terms in office.
How do we replicate that, though? Because you're talking a lot of money. That was $700,000 for that one race.
Yeah, it was. It was a huge amount of money. And it may be hard to replicate. And I think what the grassroots groups have to do is come together and to the extent possible, draw a consensus on who the three to five biggest problems are on a multitude of issues as incumbents. And then figure out, do we have that perfect storm of a really strong candidate to run against them in a primary? And can we make the commitment, even if we can't raise the money to do it the easy way with the news media, of putting people in cars and trucks and driving them to that district and going door to door? Because that, frankly, makes more of a difference than mailers and radio ads, is getting out there and going door to door. And the grassroots can do that when the incumbents, pretty much all they can do is hire college kids to do it, you know, with a shortness of genuosity in their presentations. But I think it made a huge difference in Maggart's race. You know, we battled her in the advertising and the news media and the billboards, but the thing that turned it and made a difference, I think, and I participated in this, and I know people did from Memphis to Far East Tennessee who drove over, is getting out and knocking those doors and talking to potential voters in the primary about why Maggart needed to go and why Rogers was a better choice. And you think about it, what would happen if the voters across the state came together and focused on a Harwell if there was a good candidate, or a McCormick down in Chattanooga if there was a good candidate? You know, McCormick's a Democrat convert, or a Glenn Casada, or the Speaker Pro Tem, Charles Sargent, you know, or Steve McDaniel. If you start picking off those leadership, the committee chairman, and you don't get them all, you just got to knock off two or three and make it pretty nasty. And that message is going to start getting around that, hey, you know, we better listen to our constituents more than we're listening to leadership.
For this upcoming session, what are TFA's priorities this year?
We've got a number of them. We certainly want to go back while the issue is hot and in discussion and take advantage of that AG's opinion and get some legislation moving to really fix safe commute, and that's going to frankly take repealing, I think, Ron Ramsey's language. You can't patch it. It's so bad. You know, it's going to have to be repealed and replaced. There are some other smaller statutes that need to be substantially overhauled. We want to start pushing for constitutional carry in Tennessee. Several states have enacted it, and there's no reason we don't. We want to really get back hard on Senator Beaver's Firearms Freedom Act, which is basically forcing the state officials, because they could do it now, but they won't unless they're forced to stand up to the federal government on 10th Amendment grounds and say you have no jurisdiction to regulate the ownership, manufacture, or distribution of firearms and ammunition within the state's boundaries.
Where's that on the priority list? That last one, I hope that's very, very high on your priority list.
I think it's number one or two.
Okay. Well, that and the constitutional carry. Now, if you got the constitutional carry, wouldn't the parking lot bill issue be moot?
Well, now you still got the issue whether or not you got the permit of whether or not the employer could ban possession on his property.
Okay.
So you still got the protecting the job, and you still got the posting capacity of the employer to say no guns here, criminal sanctions behind the posting statute.
Let me ask you this. I'm just curious, and I think I know the answer, but I'll throw it out there anyway. What other constitutional rights can your employer breach while you're on his property? I mean, okay, like if he doesn't like your bumper sticker, or if you have a Bible on your dashboard and it's visible and somebody's offended and scarred for life because they saw it, you know, I'm just curious.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. When the hearings were taking place on the parking lot bill, Federal Express's representative testified that as far as they were concerned, if it was on their property, they could fire employees for having Bibles in their cars. So there is a turf war, and the way we've approached the rewrite of the parking lot bill, it's not just a gun bill. It basically says if you legally own or possess the vehicle, and it's not an employer vehicle, it's an extension of your home, and you can store in your car, no matter where you park it, anything you legally own or possess. So it covers Bibles, crosses hanging from the rearview mirror, little statues of Mary, you know, whatever your swing is, including firearms, golf clubs, and whatever you may have in the trunk. If you legally own it, you can keep it there. But, you know, a lot of people have to understand this, too, that the constitutional rights, by and large, are declarations that the government shall not infringe, shall not hamper, shall not do certain things, okay?
Yeah, it's not the government creating it. It's the government recognizing a right that already exists.
Right, right. And the Bill of Rights and the constitutional protections predominantly restrict conduct by government. There really is no Second Amendment protection vis-a-vis private parties. So unless your employer is a government agency, Second Amendment really doesn't restrict the private owner. So that's why the parking lot bill is not really a Second Amendment concept, because we're not restraining government other than the prosecution, the criminal involvement. But what we're saying is we're redefining property rights. And, you know, what's interesting in that debate, legislators bit on what the Chamber of Commerce and others were passing around, is my property rights are absolute and government shouldn't tell me what I can do. And that sounds attractive to a lot of conservatives. But it's sort of like the same problem with the caps on medical malpractice we talked about earlier. Conservatives will say, yeah, that sounds right. That's my private property. Government, you can't tell me what can happen on my property. Well, most conservatives realize that rights are balanced.
Right.
If you're an adjoining
you
property
got two
owner,
primary rights there.
Yeah, if you're an adjoining property owner in a residential neighborhood, you know, your right to use your property is fundamentally restrained under the concept of nuisance, to the extent that you can't use your property in such a fashion that you materially negatively impact your neighbor. So if you live in a residential area, most people would find it offensive if you decided to start raising and slaughtering hogs en masse on your residential property. Or if you put in a rock quarry or tried to put in a helicopter landing pad. And so, you know, property rights aren't absolute and unrestricted. They're balanced so that each person has the maximum benefit within reason of using their own property, even if they're adjacent. Well, that vertical correlation, everybody sort of gets, but on the parking lot issue, all of a sudden you turn it horizontal, going up and down, and all of a sudden that car, you know, when it enters your parking lot, you know, these big businesses said, hey, if it's within the boundaries, we totally get to regulate whatever happens here. Well, that dog don't hunt necessarily if you're talking about balancing property rights.
And because it's your property as well.
Yeah.
Your vehicle is your property. Now, Tennessee has the Castle Doctrine, which already said that your vehicle is an extension of your house in terms of, you know, property rights, the Castle Doctrine and whatnot.
Right. They adopted that addition to the Castle Doctrine in 2008.
Well, I'm curious to see how it turns out here. John, I appreciate you. I apologize for the earlier technical problems that we still have, unfortunately, but I appreciate you holding, and I appreciate you staying with me well past the time, and I think we covered most of the ground, but I tell you what, I definitely want to get you back on. I'd like to get you back on either before session or once session kicks in when we kind of see what's going to be what the elitists are going to push. But I appreciate you coming on, and I'll give you the last 30 seconds there if you have anything you'd like to say before you go.
Sure. And I thank you for that. I know you've had a lot of people listening that maybe had problems getting through tonight that had questions. And any of them that have those kind of questions, the TFA has a Facebook page and a Facebook group. We have both. And you can find us on Facebook, and we'll be glad to try to answer any questions you have. We also have a website, TennesseeFirearms.com, that has a forum, and anybody, member or not, can go on there and post questions, and we'll try to answer those questions. And they can be on our forum and sign up for our email list, and we will keep them advised of what's going on in the legislature.
Well, great. Well, John, once again, I appreciate it. And you have a good night. We'll definitely have you back. Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye. Mm-hmm.